Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Women Scholars and Professionals podcast. My name is Anne Boyd, and I'll be your host. We at Women Scholars and Professionals are here to support women in their God-given callings into the university and beyond. So if you're a graduate student or a faculty member, an administrator or a student in professional school, a scholar in between jobs, or simply a person who supports women in the academic world, then this podcast is for you. What does it look like to combine a calling to write and teach with a lifestyle of nurturing the land? English professor and author Tiffany Eberle Kreiner describes the joys and tensions of her multifaceted life in her book, In Thought, Word, and Seed, Reckonings from a Midwest Farm. Tiffany shares her experiences of both teaching and caring for the earth and describes how they inform one another in remarkable ways. In a book written mostly during the pandemic, Tiffany offers insightful reflections on race, hope, faith, and the beauty of life. Her essays take unexpected angles on a story that we have all lived through in the pandemic, and she finds connections with literature that provide rich and thoughtful questions for consideration. Tiffany is winsome and fun and a joy to talk with, and I think you'll really like her. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll hear an excerpt from our conversation where Tiffany shares about the delights and challenges of raising children while pursuing an academic career. So let me tell you a little bit more about her. Tiffany Eberle Kreiner is Associate Professor of English at Wheaton College. She grew up in the North Country, upstate New York, famous both for its abundant snow and its rich community life. She attended Messiah College for her BA and the University of Wisconsin-Madison for her MA and PhD. After serving as a Carey Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the University of Notre Dame, she joined the English department at Wheaton College in Illinois. Her first book, The Future of the Word, An Eschatology of Reading, came out in 2014. When Tiffany isn't teaching and writing, she farms 60 acres of woods and fields with her husband and two children at Root and Sky Farm in rural northern Illinois. So let's dive right in. We're so glad you're here. I really want to talk about your book, which is called In Thought, Word, and Seed. But first, I'd love to start by asking you a few questions about your life as a professor. Our audience is, made up primarily of women connected with academia in one way or another. So I'm interested in focusing our conversation in that space.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us the story of your path into academia?
Absolutely. So I went into college not really knowing what direction I would take after that. I sort of thought, well, maybe missions, maybe education more broadly speaking. And my very first English class at Messiah College, my first professor, Crystal Downing, wrote on the first paper we wrote, we need to talk about you becoming a professor.
Wow.
And so it's an amazing moment of just mentorship and calling. And she became a really lifelong friend and mentor to me out of that experience. And she really guided me through that process. I came from a family where graduate school wasn't assumed or anything like that. So I didn't even know things like what's the difference between an assistant professor and an associate professor, or what's tenure or all those things. I didn't know about the structures or the discourse community norms, as we might say. So I had a lot to learn in that way. She helped me sort of make that journey into graduate school and applications and things. And I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison for my master's and PhD, and then did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Notre Dame. And now I teach at Wheaton College in Illinois.
Wonderful. So, as you look back on your life in the university, what have been some of the gifts and maybe some of the challenges you've encountered?
Well, I mean, I'm grateful for academia as a sort of way, life way in so many ways, right? The gifts that it provides, it's a good, stable provision for our family. You know, my book is a little bit about farming and academia together, but that life way has made it possible for us to have health insurance, to be able to farm, you know, all
Right.
these ways. And for me to be able to say, parent with dentist appointments, you know, I can schedule around things and so on and so forth. So it's a lovely kind of life way in many ways. But I think, you know, I was reflecting on my years as a professor recently and just feeling the joy of being able to, with students, participate in meaning making in the love of the Trinity like every day. So I'm a literature professor, so we read text together, and in discussing them, I feel like we're making meaning right there. Worry not about meaninglessness, I might say to my students, because we're making it right now. And so that is an incredible privilege. And I feel it daily in the classroom when students have ideas, when students want to participate in the conversation, when we read again texts of all sorts, great ones, and also sort of lesser known texts and things, to be able to participate in making meaningful the lives of the writers and the lives of the students who are reading them. So I love that.
That's beautiful.
I also think friendship is an amazing gift of the academic life. I have been blessed with the amazing chance to be close to colleagues across disciplines. I work at a small college, and so hang out with composers and theologians and chemists and theater makers. And it's just a really wonderful, diverse group of people to do life alongside. It's been sort of magical.
Love
So
that.
those are some of the gifts that academia has offered.
Do you feel so? I mean, in terms of challenges, do you feel like you've encountered some or overcome some?
Well, life is challenge, in the sense that
Yes.
there's a lot, you know, many dangers, toils, and snares, et cetera, for us all. So I absolutely feel that, you know, academia, we could get into the nitty-gritty here, but academia has a way of forming people a little bit toward insecurity, I think. And so, oh, are you good enough? Do you get enough gold stars? Will you be awarded tenure? Will you keep doing enough to be good enough? Are you still worth your place here? You know, like, when do you get to belong and everybody knows it, or whatever? You know, all those kinds of questions. They do have an impact on a person and how they become in the world. It affects my parenting to be formed in that way, right? To be insecure, not only on my own behalf, but also on my children's behalf. Are you good enough? Are you having a play? I'm laughing about it, but it's really great, powerful, a challenge to think about and then to try to correct for in various ways. I think, too, a major challenge is just, and this is maybe just my personal constitution, my way of being, but I feel like I have so many callings and so many interests. I love and I'm interested in most everything. And so in that sense, the abundance of opportunity, the abundance of the world around me feels most often wondrous, but sometimes overwhelming. And so even to this day, I've never been good at saying no, never wanted to miss an opportunity to make the cool thing that we could make, you know. I think that's a huge challenge. I think, too, any institutional life has its challenges, right? The drama of any job, it ha occurs in academia too. And so, you know, maintaining faithfulness as part of a relationship to an institution is a challenge, for everyone, I think.
Well, Tiffany, as you think about the listeners to this of this podcast, what advice might you have for a young grad student or a new faculty person as they're starting out?
Well, so I remember when one of my colleagues talked to me soon after I got tenure and said, I could tell the second you had tenure because your whole person and demeanor changed to this kind of relaxing or this ability to be at home. And I was so surprised by the idea of being at home and what that means or what that changes in your behavior. But I've always admired about people in academia, those who could be at home before then, which is to say, to be an inviter. So I think making invitations to others actually makes you at home. It puts you in that space of belonging into a space. And so for people who are beginning, if you don't have your writers group yet, if you don't have a feeling of friendship or camaraderie, if you feel overwhelmed by workflow and you just need sort of goal groups or on-taskness or any of those stressors and things, I think the key is to invite people into a space with you, to be the one who says, okay, it's scones today, you know, at the bakery, and we'll just have it. It doesn't have to be long or whatever. To be the one who's always inviting people, is, I think, the way to be in academia. It becomes, of course, not just social too. I mean, one of the great things when you, again, one of those great things about having a little bit of seniority is you begin to say, you know what, who would be great for that lecture? So and so, we should invite them. And to notice and say, like, we should have these two people meet because they would make something amazing together in this panel. And that habit of or way of being, like, what could we make out of this? Who can we invite? I think is a key posture toward thriving in academia. So that can happen formally. Like, I used to run a humanities colloquium. And I would just be the one who, okay, let's get somebody from the languages, let's get somebody from here, you know, and kind of make those invitations. But that really formal experience makes me want to do that in all sorts of ways, to be the one who says, you know what would be good? We just need to write together. So let's figure out a, like, no talking writing session. Okay, I'll organize it. And nobody's cooking anything because we don't need that. We're just gonna go. You know, stuff like that. So all that to say, I think invitation is a great virtue to cultivate for a younger person. I think it's more useful a piece of advice than to say get a writing group because or one of those groups, because I remember feeling like, well, I'm not worthy. Who would want to be in a writing group with me? You know, like, I don't deserve that kind of thing. I'm not scholarly enough. They have elbow patches and I do not have elbow patches. And you know, I literally thought that way. Like, that's a thought I have thought about others. And so, in that sense, to change from, you know, what spaces do I deserve to be in, to sort of making spaces for others to feel at home in, is, I think, a good way to do that. With the caveat that one shouldn't get too involved in the, I mean, I say this because I'm super involved in the cooking. I do think it does take a long time. So, like, to, you know,
So true.
circumscribe some of those excellence in cake making or whatever. So that's a thought there. I also think that I've been just experimenting with this over the last few years since I've gotten a spiritual director, but to try to change my mindset from treating the path into academia as a series of things to get through. Like, I think that I've just got to get these requirements out of the way as an undergrad, or I've just got to get through these exams, or I've just got to get through the dissertation, or I've just got to get through these things, and then I'll be able to do whatever. And if I think pivoting away from that idea from through to with is a way better way. So this is the life right now, and we are doing it with God right now. And so if we can change that mindset and flip it to all I've got is this extremely painful time right now, Lord Jesus, here you are. What do you want out of this? Us together, you know, where are we going with this? And Right, so far so good in terms of the trying, and I don't know that I would have always articulated it that way by any means. Although I do tell students, stop saying you're going to get your requirements out of the way. But
Right.
I'm a liberal arts person, so I was very much interested in all of the things. But I do think it might be helpful for folks.
Well, I am very excited to talk with you about your book. The title is In Thought, Word, and Seed: Reckonings from a Midwest Farm. And this book is a beautiful series of essays, and it was such a delight to read, but I thought kind of a little difficult to categorize. So I thought I would just begin by asking about the title, which I feel like says a lot in itself. So can you unpack that title for us?
Sure. So In Thought, Word, and Seed is a riff on prayer, right? We have sinned, a confession. We have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, in what we have done and left undone. And since many of the essays in the book were dealing with a kind of confession and repentance of various kinds, sometimes from what seems to be just overwhelm, right? I have too many things to do. I don't know what the right thing is to do. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Or something like that. And so, in our my own unique place, I guess, in a farming life and a professorial life and a parenting life and life in this town rather than a different town has occasioned a series of reflections, a series of problems of vocation and beauty and holiness and racial justice. And those problems become occasions for engagement with the Lord and repentance associated with the various things that come out through those reflections.
Well, and it I'm curious a little bit to I'm curious to hear about how this book came to be, because you wrote at least part of it, I mean maybe quite a lot of it during the pandemic. So can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Sure. So when I finished my first book, it was my tenure book, and I sort of promised my husband after that that we'd get to do what he wanted to do for a while. And so in the seasons of sort of shared life, I said, okay, let's make you a farm. It had been a long time dream of his to do that. And so that occasioned a major upheaval in our lives, right? To, we're not extremely good at all the details of life and sort of settling, all the household that we had and moving into this new place, spending several years finding a place, et cetera. Those changes required so much of us, just changing a whole way. We didn't have any background in farming. We wanted to start new. And so that whole change, in a scholarly way, left me with significantly reduced time, right? So if I had thought, oh, my next book is going to be about this literary studies topic or whatever, it was going to be hard to do that. And so again, because I like everything, I'm interested in everything, I thought, well, whatever I do next, it's going to have to weave all the things together. So in some ways, the reason this book is hard to categorize is because it's literary studies and what was happening at home, and theology, right? All kind of together, in sort of hybrid lyric essay form. So all that to say, it came about by trying to manage those multiple pressures. And in terms of the actual mechanism of its coming about, it happened too by invitation. This editor of a journal called Word and World reached out to me and said, I read your first book. I'd like you to write for us. We do pastoral theology. Your book's in literary studies, but we think it could cross over. Here's how. Write anything you want. And so I was super interested in that invitation. I was honored by it. I was shocked that someone had actually read the book, and so I wrote the first piece for them, which was the owl chapter. And so he liked it. He invited me to write again, and it was the wattle chapter. And then suddenly, when he was, inviting me the second time, I thought, well, gosh, there might be something here, And so I started to formulate it as a sabbatical was coming up, got a grant for the Forest chapter with my institution. And so those invitations and helps became the sort of mechanisms by which, in the middle of a pandemic, something like this could be eked out. And it was eked. I mean, I wouldn't have done it without the invitation. There was just so much going on.
Oh,
How?
yeah.
I was, the homestead that we came to was wrecked. And so we had to like scrape things off and get the squirrels to stop living in the house and things like that, So many adventures, but those invitations made it possible to write anything, even during the time of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So grateful for them.
Well, it came together so beautifully. I mean, I found it so intriguing to read and to see the way you paired these thoughtful readings of literature with this farm-based lifestyle. It's so integrated, all of it. And I know there's a long tradition of this kind of writing. I kept thinking of Wendell Berry as I was reading, and I'm interested to know a little bit more about what this is like for you. You know, what's it like for your life of the mind world to connect with the daily rhythms and tasks of caring for the earth?
Ideal comes to mind as a way. I mean, I think there's a reason that Wendell Berry's work and say Annie Dillard's work or whatever, right? Not farming for Annie Dillard, but the
Sure.
natural world and the world of poetry or
Yeah.
thoughtfulness come together so marvelously as embodied beings, right? Attentiveness to where we are makes complete sense. And so in some ways, well, I can give a concrete example. So, in the Wattle chapter, the last chapter of the book, I build a wattle fence, and then I wrote an essay, kind of in the shape of a wattle fence, using quotations as the kind of uprights and these little mini memoir bits as the withies that sort of fold in and around those upright stands. And so that essay is super odd, but I seemed to need to build the fence to make the essay. It didn't happen any other way. I mean, I'm sure I could have imagined it in some way, but I don't know if you felt like this during the opening of the pandemic, but I felt stir crazy. I'm sitting in front of a screen all day. What am I even doing? What is this? I don't have any groundedness. What's this new world that we're entering into? And so the real actual world of like post-hole, I mean, there's like heavy hammers that pound in stakes, and the saw and loppers to cut things, to cut these branches that will fold in and through those uprights. So powerfully physical, I could think then. I mean, I remember one day when I was actually listening to a faculty meeting while I was doing it. I mean, right, shh, don't tell. No, but it was fantastic. Like that was what I needed to be able to respond well to crisis, to like think carefully and be with God, was to move my body. And I think that's, some people run, some
Yeah.
people walk, and those are great ways too. This just has offered ample opportunity for the space that reflection requires. I think I would probably have filled it all up with some doom scrolling or some urgent, repeatable task that is not rejuvenating, and in some laundry or something like that, right? That would feel enervating in some way, but this didn't. This and farm work, even though it does have its rhythms and repetition, is a gift for me. Even though at times, very, very hard, especially
Sure,
anxiety
sure.
and so on. But yeah.
Well, yeah, the pandemic was quite a time.
Yes.
Well, and in that time, you touch on the racial reckoning that comes up at the time. You in the book, you touch on themes related to the murder of George Floyd in 2020, and you have an entire chapter framed with letters addressed to James Baldwin. So I'm wondering how your writing created space for you to think deeply about race and culture in your life and in connection with your community.
Absolutely. Well, I'll start personally about how writing makes space for this. My father always says, and in fact, there's a quotation posted of his on my door that says, "It's better when Tiffany's writing," which is to say that writing has been a way since I was a child to think for me, to make progress on an idea instead of just circle, circle, circle in my mind going through things. So it's always been a way, writing has always been a way to do that. For me, and remembering that is really important when things are getting all squirrely. I need to just sit down and do some writing about it. And it seems to me that over long years, decades of studying African American literature and teaching it, and seeing patterns emerge again, again and again, examples of the way that the United States handles racial injustice, that when George Floyd was murdered, regular old white guilt was not going to be sufficient for that, right? Regular old signaling of a certain kind of virtue through certain kinds of actions and behaviors was never going to be useful. I felt the feelings of guilt. I felt the feelings of action and wanting to signal all my thoughts, whatever in particular ways, definitely had all those feelings. But it wasn't going to be the thing to do. Like it wasn't, that wasn't going to change anything. It wasn't going to atone for anything. It was going to, sh was not going to show me to be in the right position or a good white person. It wasn't going to do any of that. And so feeling that sense of futility about whatever I was going to do, think rightly or show up to a protest, which I talk a little bit about in the chapter, but so I needed to do more serious theological thinking. I needed to do more serious thinking about like my town in particular, this town in Northern Illinois, very rural, largely majority white town. And so how does what is happening with George Floyd, what's happening with the larger vicissitudes of race in the United States going to be played out here? And so my constant reading companion on such topics has always been James Baldwin since graduate school. I remember, the sort of day when Goethe on the Mountain became a sort of magically powerful text for me. I decided that he would be the best person to sort of talk to about this because, again, you can't just process whatever your white guilt is with, it was just anybody. I wanted to sort of do the thinking in a really like powerful way with the Lord, with an interlocutor, but I didn't want to cause anybody any problems. I didn't want to like tax anyone. So I thought I would write to James Baldwin as a kind of I mean, it's perhaps too glib to say communion of saints or cloud of witnesses or something like that because I don't want to proclaim or stamp him with a certain religious title or something like that. But I was thinking about it a little bit in that way. To do that kind of work. And so it became a space to process serious more seriously than those other ways that I had done before.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Well, you also you mentioned too that you were on a sabbatical during the pandemic, and you write about it, and you write that not only was there a pandemic, but you found yourself caring for your husband with long COVID and taking on extra farm tasks in the process. And you write very honestly, I wrote this down. You write, "I'm taking on as many chores as I can, but not graciously, despite believing in the virtue of helpfulness. I'm evilly cranky, ungenerous, wanting to be worshipped for the great sacrifice of my sabbatical hours," which just seemed so relatable to me. And your sabbatical is not the first one I've heard of that was interrupted by challenging circumstances. And you really described that inner struggle so well. So can you say a little bit more about how that time shaped you and how, or even if you felt like you were able to redeem that sabbatical time?
I too have heard a lot of colleagues talk about what happens when you have a sabbatical. You get sick finally. Your body's been holding off. You get sick, perhaps seriously sick, or someone in your family does, or all of the, psychological collapse you've been holding off for years with children or whatever sort of comes to a head. And so, in some ways, there was a kind of, oh man, feeling about,
Right.
here it is, just another example of losing out or whatever, like these
Right.
bitter, terrible feelings. And so I think in terms of making it through or how the time was redeemed, it feels to me when I look at the book now, like I feel a kind of wonder that it happened, that it got done at all. I kind of can't believe it. And I remember the day when I sort of finished the last chapter that I was writing and the sense of kind of, what? Like, thank you. I have no idea what you did, God, to make this happen because this was a really rough, terrible time. And I don't even know how survival happened, let alone a book coming out of it. So I don't think I did anything to redeem the sabbatical. In fact, if I had to sort of talk about like repenting of that sense of like martyrdom sacrifice, or like it was a really important thing. Like I realized, I remember a moment in the field where I felt as if, now perhaps the Lord isn't this sarcastic, but a moment I felt as if God was saying something like, well, did you really mean to actually like lay down your life and take up your cross? Because this is
Right.
what that is. Like this is what it is when you're doing this chore. And perhaps he doesn't use that tone with everyone or even with me. Maybe I was sort of, just preaching to myself. But it was a good sermon if I was preaching to myself because I do. Like, it is hard to take up your cross. It is hard to lay down your life. It is hard to do those things. And yet, I'm moved by the way that God forms us toward over, or just the mercy over the years into people who will, for whom it will be a little easier next time. That maybe through that experience, I can, do life with God enough so that it will feel better or easier to give the next time. And that's what I want to be formed toward, I guess. So I feel like this book was a present in a way, a chance for it not to have meant nothing, though it could have easily done so, could have easily seemed like that, an entire loss, like so many of us lost so much during the
Yeah.
time. Dreams of all kinds.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think I did anything to redeem it. There was a lot of work, but it was also like thrilling,
Yeah.
when it could happen.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you received the challenges and the gifts that God gave to you in that moment, and we get to read some of the fruits of that.
Thank you for doing so. That too
Yes.
feels like, what?
It's a joy. And I really want to point out one of the things I loved about your writing is that you infuse your faith. It's just clear in your language and in your thinking that that your faith is integrated into your work and your writing. So I'm curious to know if you have any habits or practices that support your faith integration in your teaching, in your writing, and other professional tasks.
Absolutely. So I think that the integration of the book, especially the Waddle chapter, happened as I was proceeding through the Ignatian exercises with a spiritual director. And so that beautifully intense season of reflection and care, an hour a day richly devoted to contemplation, scriptural meditation, prayer, I think helped or bore fruit in the actual structure of the language. And so I commend or recommend that to anyone who can. It was a great, great blessing to be able to do that with my spiritual director, Rhonda. And so that was helpful. And as a sort of person who has grown up Pentecostal, non-denominational and things, this is a whole wonder world to me, to try something new like that. But in terms of teaching in life, I do have a practice that I think I can even recommend. When We enter my classroom. Now, I teach at a Christian college, but I think this is probably transferable in a different form to a different kind of space. But my class times begin with really consciously trying to help people to get into the room together, to be in the room together. And so we start out with a time of quiet in the classroom, and I sort of say, oh, it's the same spiel. I can imagine you doing several things with this quiet time. One is you could just breathe for a little minute here, just inhale and exhale. Or I say, you could remember that there are other people in the room, other people with problems and thoughts and joys and things that are not related hugely to your own. They have other things. It's good to remember this. And then I say, or you could call out for mercy. You could just cry out for mercy. You might need to be there in this moment. And so we have, 1 or 2 minutes of silence that start off our class. And then we read a portion of scripture, the same portion every class period for the whole semester. So for my class on contemporary literary conversations about neighborhood, we do the Good Samaritan, or we do a psalm in a different class. And those, so over the course of the semester, students basically memorize the scripture, which they've heard some 32 times, by the end, and have had some periods of quiet that help them to come into that space. And I have found that just extremely meaningful, for me, for my students, for sure. And there are other things that we do to kind of get to know each other and so on. So that's not the whole of the pedagogy or anything, but I think it's a spiritual practice that has really helped me see the classroom as a space where God is. I feel like that could be anybody, anywhere. My daughter and I have been doing some work with Every Moment Holy books of sort of daily liturgy or occasional liturgies, right? Which have been really delightful and so on. But anything we can do to say this moment and this moment and this moment, God is here, and this one also, and here he is, and me too, or whatever, right? To sort of show up to the meeting of eternity and time, with our whole selves.
Yeah. Well, I would love to talk a little bit more specifically about women in academic and professional contexts and how they might use your book and enjoy it. So, is there, I wonder if there's a chapter or an element of it that you would like to recommend or highlight, particularly for women in our audience?
Sure. Yes. So I think that chapter that most centrally deals with concerns that I think would overlap with those that you just described would be the chapter Forest. In that chapter, I use Middlemarch and The Wasteland and Their Eyes Were Watching God and other texts to contemplate the problem of multiple vocations. The question that Dorothea in Middlemarch asks is, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? She, if readers are not familiar, one of the storylines in the great novel Middlemarch, which everyone should read immediately, but one of the storylines is about a young, very bright woman who has some education and a great desire to do good. How best should she serve God with her life? And she decides to marry a man that she thinks is smart, who will help make that decision for her. But she asks throughout the entire novel, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? And then when she is married, how does my marriage bear on that question of what I should do? I have a pretty strong duty to this one person. How do my desires to do good for others outside that circle of our family fit with, push against some of those concerns? So that the chapter is a way to try to think, like, here we are, we have this time, we have all these vocations. How do we decide what to do? I find it a fraught question all the time, and that maybe our family has a fair bit of ADHD in it. So, like, getting a task committed to from the buffet of tasks available is quite challenging for us. It's something that I deal with really practically every day, but also in the ultimate sense. So if sacrifice and giving is a major virtue and a major value, well, how do you decide what to give and when and how, given all the opportunities for doing so? And so I use actually Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree to actually think about that, because that text has been super meaningful in my life. But you know, after a certain point, all you've got is that stump there. And so what do you, you know, was that the wisest choice, the resource allocation, or whatever? Yeah. So I think, I hope that people who are reflecting on some of those questions will at least find someone who shares that sense.
Yeah, that's
Right.
great.
Multipleness.
That's a great recommendation. Thank you. Well, this has been such a delightful conversation. And I know that our readers would enjoy knowing how to follow you and your work. What is on the horizon for you?
Well, so a little backstory on the horizon. I remember the first time I studied John Milton seriously in graduate school. I had the great David Lowenstein as a professor, and I remember him saying, you know, Milton wrote only one of each thing, but he wrote the best one of each thing that had ever been written, you know, an epic, a tragedy, and so on, and you know, a very worshipful stance toward Milton. But I remember when I heard that, I thought, oh, that's the model I want to pursue, is trying one of everything. I, you
Interesting.
know, I make no claim of Miltonic grandiosity, though I'm sure I have some hopes, but I like to try lots of things. So I expect that future work that I will do will be different. I have interest in writing poems. I have interest in writing fiction. I have interest in writing plays. I would like to consider opera. I would like to, you know, all these possible ways of being. My appointment is in American literature, which I love. And I'm not adverse to continuing to do scholarly work, but I've actually even moved in my institution to doing public humanities and arts work with advanced students who come together in cohorts. So we do large community projects, after school programs, older adults, creativity programs, and so on. So I want to try lots of things. So if it's my work you're interested in, you're just gonna have to Google, because there won't be a potential place, I think, for it. The next projects are starting and emerging, but I hope to try as many as the years that God gives me. So we'll see how it goes.
Tiffany's ability to combine the life of the mind with the earthiness of farming inspires me to seek ways that I can be more fully integrated in the different spheres of my own life. I'm grateful for her presence in all of her circles and for this book that shows us some of her process. I hope you check out her book, which you can find wherever books are sold. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll get to hear a bonus from our podcast, where Tiffany shares about the delights and challenges of raising children while pursuing an academic career. The Women Scholars and Professionals podcast is hosted by me, Anne Boyd, and is a production of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. We acknowledge that the opinions of our guests may not necessarily represent the ministry, doctrine, or policies of InterVarsity. You can find more information about our podcast and the other cool things we are doing at thewell.intervarsity.org. Our work is funded solely through the donations of our listeners and supporters. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you might consider joining our support team by donating even $10 per month. You can find out how to do this at our website. To ensure others will find and enjoy our podcasts as well, please consider rating and reviewing our podcast and sharing it with others. And as we close, listen in on this excerpt from my conversation with Tiffany. I'm curious to ask, I like the way that you frame your life way, as it sounds like you have an element of flexibility in order to get kids to dentist appointments and things like that. We also hear from women who feel really sometimes, I think, oppressed by the responsibilities of life as a professor while also raising children. Have you found a way through that, or is your mindset one that you can just roll with it a little more easily? I'm just curious how that works for you.
Yeah, so When I feel most sort of mentally healthy and spiritually healthy, the rolling with it feels much more possible.
Right.
So it's, when I haven't slept, oh dear, it's way too much and it's
Right.
oppressive. So yeah, I can equally sympathize with both who will talk about the benefits and those who will talk about the challenges there. I can say amen to a person who says this is just unsustainable, and be like, yes, I know. Let's go out. It's fine. So I do hear that. And I have friends who manage it in different ways, right? A friend who is the scheduling queen, who has every minute in a spreadsheet and the family knows, and she's an air traffic controller, and it's amazing. And I have a friend who manages super carefully by being super selective and saying no to things. Like, power to say no is it astounds me. It's so powerful. And I think when I, when I think of us getting through as a family together, I think of just the mercy of the Lord in getting us through. I mean, I don't want to be romantic about it at all, but I don't really know how we've made it this far, except
Right, right.
mercy. In the sense that, my husband and I have different seasons of intensity times of year, so that helps. We can take one for each other from time to time, and that really helps. And my children's just understanding and interest in lots of things has been a huge part of that, I think. But more
Yeah.
than anything, the mercy.